The craft of the flats boat allowed him to cross over countless underwater obstacles by simply raising the outboard motor. Standing on the poling platform in shorts and a t-shirt and moving the boat with a long fiberglass pole, he looked to any observer like just another angler looking for bonefish in this world-class fishing destination. Reese found a protected cove where he could pull the boat in close to the shore and dropped anchor. The Admiral's Jag had regained consciousness and was jabbering on endlessly, taking no responsibility for his part in the plot to kill Reese's troop and family, begging for his life and blaming everyone he could think of for the current predicament. Reese cut the plastic ties binding Howard's feet and tossed the senior officer over the side, watching him flail wildly until he discovered the water was only chest deep. Reese slid over the gunwale and shoved the naval judge advocate toward the mangrove-tangled shoreline. Howard tripped constantly on the exposed roots of the native trees, and it took them what seemed like an eternity to reach the dry, sandy ground of the island. The Jag fell to his knees in front of a sable palm tree and began to pray loudly. Reese looked down in disgust at a man who would seek the help of God after sending so many good men to early deaths without remorse. Howard's hat had fallen off somewhere, and Reese attempted to grasp a handful of the man's balding hair, but what was left after the military regulation haircut slipped through his fingers. On his second attempt, Reese grabbed the petrified attorney by the throat and hoisted him skyward, holding an evil-looking blade in the other hand. "Stand the fuck up," he growled, as he yanked the captain to his feet and shoved him back against the tree. "I want you to know what's happening to you. You are a traitor, a coward, and a disgrace to the uniform you wore. You served 68 good men up to the enemy on a silver fucking platter so that you could rise alongside that shitty excuse for an admiral. You are the lowest piece of human shit alive. Look at me! Look at me when I talk to you, motherfucker!" Just as his enemy had lost control in their quest for power, Reese lost control and succumbed to the primal need for vengeance, all the emotions of the past several weeks boiling to the surface as he stood in front of the Navy attorney who had facilitated the deaths of his men half a world away.
"I don't know what you're talking about, Reese. I'm just a Jag. I don't know what you're saying,"
Howard pled with his eyes closed, blood still streaming down his battered face. His denial sent Reese over the edge with rage. It was time for Howard to die. Reese slashed him across the lower abdomen with the curved blade of his razor-sharp, half-face karambit knife, splitting the lawyer's abdominal wall and sending his intestines spilling out onto the marshy ground. Howard released an animalistic screech and grasped for his bowels, desperately trying to shove them back inside the gaping opening. The wound bled surprisingly little.
"My God! My God!"
were the only words he could muster, repeating them over and over in agony, his pleas for divine intervention going unanswered. Reese showed no mercy, dropping the karambit to the ground and pulling his dynamis razorback belt knife from his waistband. He wielded the knife with violent grace, deftly skewering Howard's intestines with the tip of the blade, but carefully not severing them, then jammed the tip of the knife into the soft, pulpy trunk of the tree, tethering the Jag to it with his own entrails. "Walk," Reese said in a calm voice that contrasted sharply from the screams of rage he'd used just seconds earlier. "Walk around this tree, or I'll gut your kids while you watch." Leonard Howard stumbled forward in shocked silence, making his way slowly around the tree's circumference, all the while wrapping himself tighter and tighter to the trunk with his own intestines, finally collapsing to the ground, convulsing in tears, with his back against the trunk.
"Please, please, don't leave me here, please,"
he breathed.
"I'll tell you anything you need to know."
"That's just it, Howard," Reese said, leaning in close. "I've already got what I need. Now I'm just going to watch you die."
"I didn't want to."
"You didn't want to what? You didn't want to kill my troop? You didn't want to kill my wife? My daughter?"
My son? Not good enough, Howard. Not even close. Don't worry, you won't die in vain. Your death serves a purpose. You get to send a message to what's left of your band of conspirators. If you're lucky, you'll go into shock before the rats start eating you alive. Gazing up at his killer, Howard remembered the look Reese had given him back in the Admiral's office in what seemed so long ago. Death. Reese stared into the hollow eyes of the dead man at his feet, his stomach a gaping hole that would provide ample sustenance for the creatures of the swamp. The bowel smell overwhelmed Reese's nostrils. Howard was already attracting flies and mosquitoes. The crows and rats would come next, followed by the crabs. An American crocodile was not out of the question in these parts. He would probably live for several hours as he was slowly eaten alive by the jungle, so long as his heart held out. It would be a couple of days before anyone would find what was left of his body, and that would be just enough time for Reese to prepare the final stages of his plan. Reese wiped his karambit clean on Howard's soaked pant leg and walked swiftly back toward the boat, the seal-designed razorback blade securing Howard to the tree, leaving no question as to the identity of the Jag's executioner. Reese didn't reflect upon what had possessed him to inflict such a ruthless act, but he was a student of warfare. It had come from the deep recesses of his subconscious memory. The Incas had devised this gruesome method of execution centuries ago in order to send a message. North American tribes, including the Shawnee, had used it as well. Sendero Luminoso in Peru adopted it in the 1980s as a brutally effective method to win the minds of locals and dissuade the government from being overly effective in their efforts to eradicate them. While the indigenous tribes and the modern terrorist group did it to strike fear into the souls of those that opposed them, Reese did it as the visceral act of a man overcome by rage. Let those whom he hunted lose sleep wondering if they were to meet with a similar fate. Chapter 60. The drive north was frustrating. The lone artery that runs the length of the Keys was choked with tourists, residents, and fishermen towing boats to various points north. To a man who had just blown up an admiral in his office, shot a federal agent in his bed, decapitated a terrorist, and left a man disemboweled and dying in a mangrove swamp, the stop-and-go traffic was maddening. Reese would be hard to recognize with his hat, sunglasses, and beard, but a driver's license check would bring the full weight of U.S. law enforcement scrambling in his direction. A simple traffic stop would likely result in the end of Reese's mission. He was careful not to speed when the traffic let up enough for that to be a possibility, and he used his turn signals like a teenager trying to pass driver's ed. North of Key Largo, traffic relented a bit, and the flow northward toward Miami put him slightly more at ease. Reese tensed as the truck reached the southern end of Miami's suburban sprawl. Aggressive drivers cut in and out of lanes and, at 3 miles per hour over the posted speed limit, Reese felt like he was driving a farm tractor. He sped up a bit to stay in the flow of traffic, but maintained his position in the right lane. He glanced down at the folded-up map on his lap and prepared to merge onto the Palmetto Expressway for his return to the airfield. As he eased the pickup onto the access road for 826, he was suddenly cut off by a tricked-out orange Honda Civic that looked like a prop car from one of the Fast and Furious movies. He hit the brakes to avoid colliding with the tiny coupe and heard a screech of tires, followed by the crunch of metal and plastic. Reese's head slammed backward in the headrest as the inertia of the rear-end collision pushed his borrowed truck forward and then to a stop. Fuck. It was a hard hit, but Reese was none the worse for wear. I can't believe this whole thing could go south over a fender bender. Think, Reese. You'd better talk your way out of this one. Reese looked in the side mirror to see a morbidly overweight man, roughly his own age, climb down from his lifted Ford Excursion. The driver was walking directly toward Reese's driver's side door as swiftly as his considerable bulk allowed.
Reese took a deep breath and forced a smile as he opened the truck door and stepped out to meet the fast-approaching driver. The other man was within arm's reach by the time Reese had his feet on the ground. Dressed in orange and green Miami Hurricanes athletic shorts and a white tank top that showed off his heavy investment in tattoos, the large man carried himself with the air of a bully, one of those guys who act as if their size comes from muscle rather than fat. He pointed his finger toward Reese's face and tilted his head forward to look over his mirrored sunglasses. The man's face was red with anger, and spittle flew from his lips as he shouted,
"Oye! You wrecked my truck, you gringo maricón!"
Reese raised his hands in mock surrender. "Sorry, man, that guy cut me off, and I had to slam on the brakes to keep from crashing into him. I'm sure we can work this out. I've got good insurance. I have no idea who this truck is registered to or whether it even has insurance. I wonder whether USAA will drop me for being a domestic terrorist." Their accident was backing up traffic. Horns were blowing, and impatient drivers began crossing the diagonally striped merge lines to drive around them and access the Palmetto. The man stepped even closer to Reese, well inside his reach.
"Fuck your insurance, puta. You're gonna pay me for this shit right now, or I'm gonna shoot your fucking ass."
It was doubtful that this guy had a gun in his elastic waistband, but he probably had one in the car.
"Easy, friend, easy. Let's just exchange information and get on our way. We don't need to wait around for the cops to come."
A woman, who Reese assumed to be the man's wife or girlfriend, stepped out of the passenger side of the truck, screaming in Spanish and waving her arms. As Reese tried to calm the man down, whatever she was saying appeared to make him even more agitated. She kept pointing at the damage and screaming while Reese pled with the man to relax.
"My wife is calling the cops right now. This shit is all your fault."
"We don't need to do that, man. I can pay you cash. Just follow me to an ATM. The driver turned his head to look back at his wife.
"Too late," was all he said before Reese's left arm encircled his antagonist's right arm, tying it up and rendering it useless, while at the same time driving his right hand straight up, palm open, into the underside of the man's chin.
The force of Reese's blow broke the jaw and destroyed what was probably a bad set of teeth anyway, but more important, it caused the man's brain to hit the back of his skull and bounce back inside his head, sending a shockwave through his nervous system and knocking him immediately unconscious. The man's knees buckled and gravity sent all 380 pounds directly downward. His head smashed on the asphalt street with a sickening thunk. His female companion jumped from the car screaming, a phone pressed to her ear. Reese leapt into the driver's seat of his truck and pulled the shift lever down into drive. He slammed on the accelerator and felt the truck strain as the tires spun, barely moving forward. The accident had entangled the two heavy vehicles into one gigantic train of steel. Reese put the Dodge in neutral, pressed a button on the left side of the dash to engage the four-wheel drive, and put the truck into its lowest gear. He accelerated forward, dragging the heavier Ford SUV behind him as the engine raced to produce enough torque. He knew he couldn't travel far this way, but for now it was all he had. "I've got to get out of this truck." He drove up the sweeping overpass toward the expressway, leaving the fat man's hysterical wife behind, and glanced down at the map to determine his next move. The map gave him an idea. As he reached the middle of a long turn, he swerved right and then left as he slammed on the brakes. The two trucks slid into position, blocking both lanes of the highway overpass from one concrete guardrail to the other. He engaged the parking brake on the Dodge and put the keys and map into his pocket. He slid over the bench seat to the passenger side and grabbed his backpack from the floorboard as he opened the passenger door. Horns were already blowing as he climbed over the guardrail and dangled from the edge.
"Fuck me."
Reese released his grip, dropped his chin to his chest, and placed his feet and bent knees together to prepare for what was surely to be a painful impact. It had been almost 20 years since the Army Black Hat instructors at Fort Benning had taught Reese the parachute landing fall, or PLF for short. But there are some things that you never forget. The balls of his feet hit the gravel and he rolled to his side, distributing the impact of the fall from his feet onto his calves, thighs, hips, and back.
The technique, developed to allow rapidly descending parachutists to avoid injury, also worked well for a man on the run to drop from a highway overpass onto the rail bed below. Reese's body had endured lots of wear and tear since his jump school days as a young SEAL, and he lay still for a moment to assess his body's condition. He felt hurt, not injured, so he rolled into the prone position and up into a kneel. His right knee buckled slightly as he put his weight on it, but he was able to hobble forward with minimal pain. None of the commuters seemed to notice or care that a man had climbed onto the Metro Rail platform from the rails below. They were all too engrossed in their smartphones. A young boy did notice, but when he tried to tell his mother that a man had fallen from the sky and landed on the tracks, she nodded at him while continuing her online shopping spree. Dadeland was the commuter rail system's terminus, and a train arrived after less than a minute of waiting. If anyone outside Miami had ever heard of Dadeland, it was probably because of the 1979 Dadeland Massacre, a bloody shootout in a parking lot that came to symbolize Miami's epidemic of drug violence. Reese hoped there wasn't going to be a second bloody shootout in Dadeland, but he was ready just in case. He unzipped the backpack to allow him access to his handgun and held the bag down at his left side as he stepped onto the train. The entire side of the Metro Rail car was painted with a Wi-Fi advertisement, which prompted Reese to retrieve his iPhone from the back pocket of his pack. He prayed they hadn't found a way to track it, but he had no choice other than the burner phone he was saving for a last resort. He powered up the device, connected to the Wi-Fi signal, and opened the Signal app. Had to ditch the truck on the Metro heading north from the Dadeland Station Green Line. Need to plan an extract soon. Cops probably looking for me. Liz Riley must have been looking at her phone since her response came back almost immediately.
I'll make a plan. Wait one.
Reese pulled the map out of his pocket and began looking at options. The SEAL in him told him to go to the water, but there didn't appear to be a maritime route to an airfield unless he could get a hold of a boat. He looked up, hearing sirens, but they were headed away from him toward the crash scene. His phone vibrated.
Unless you have to bail, stay on the Green Line until the Okeechobee Station. Looks like 20 stops. I'll get a ride and pick you up there.
Reese consulted the station map on the wall of the Metro car and looked down at the map. Shit, I'm going to be stuck on this damn train forever. Okay, I'll let you know if I have to divert. What are you driving? If it gets hot, leave me and I'll make my own way. Reese moved to the front of the car and leaned against the corner so that he could see the entire space. Everyone appeared to be engrossed in their phones, and no one paid him any attention. Apparently, between the beard, the ball cap, and the sunglasses, he wasn't recognizable from the media reports he assumed must be out by now, though he had yet to see any. As the train worked its way north, Reese examined the South Miami landscape, keeping a sharp eye out for any sign of law enforcement activity. Then it was through the University of Miami campus, passing next to the baseball field. He breathed a sigh of relief every time the doors shut and the train continued northward. The tracks paralleled US 1 and took Reese north through downtown Miami and its towering skyscrapers. Reese couldn't believe how the city's skyline had changed since his last visit here. The ride continued through some slum areas north of downtown before turning westward into mainly residential areas. From the train, Reese could view the roofs of tract homes arranged in perfect grids as far as the eye could see. The scene reminded him a bit of some of the crowded cityscapes that he'd seen in places like Baghdad and Manila. After a painfully long train ride, the station diagram indicated that Reese was one stop away from Okeechobee. He pulled the iPhone out and saw that he had a message alert. He logged back into Signal and saw a new message from Liz.
Out front. Black Honda minivan. All clear.
Reese scanned the area around the approaching station as much as possible through the train's windows. The car came to a stop and the doors jolted open. A few passengers disembarked quickly and fewer still brushed past them to board the train without a sliver of courtesy or patience. Reese had figured out the timing of the stops after enduring station after station, staring intently at the screen of his phone as the passengers came and went. When he knew he had a second or two before the doors began to close, he feigned surprise and sprinted off the car. Anyone who had been shadowing him from inside the train would be heading off to the next station without him. A quick glance back at the platform confirmed that no one had exited behind him. Reese pulled his hat down tight to remain as protected as possible from any facial recognition cameras that might be at the station. Grant money from Homeland Security had helped create a surveillance state in population centers across the nation, and mass transit systems were some of the most popular sites. The rail platform was elevated above ground level, which allowed Reese a good vantage point from which to observe the area. Looking over the rail, he spotted Liz's borrowed minivan idling next to the curb below. Nothing appeared out of the ordinary, but this was exactly the kind of choke point where ambushes took place.